They were 3 days out from the tavern. The rain had diminished but not stopped, and Scorpio was inclined to think of his surroundings as a rain jungle, which in his mind was one step more impenetrable and uncomfortable than a rainforest. Finally, they came to a river that didn't have endless trees poking out of it, and he moved the vehicle onto it, where it floated smoothly and began picking up speed. Overhead were a variety of avians, mostly bright red and yellow, a few blue, one large one that seemed to prey on the others, a rich green, all of them seemingly impervious to the constant rain. There were myriads of water flowers of every imaginable shape and colour, each reaching high and opening up its petals to the life-giving rain. There were a few large beasts in the water. Most ignored them, and the vehicle, now a vessel, easily avoided the others. Scorpio found that he was actually relaxing and enjoying the trip when Sapphire leaned forward.
"Slow down," she said.
"We're not going that fast," he replied.
"Nevertheless," she said, "we're going to leave the river and go back on land very soon now."
Scorpio looked ahead. The trackless jungle bordering the river looked exactly the same as it had for the past 50 miles.
"Are you sure?" he said, frowning.
"Absolutely."
"I can't believe this area has ever been mapped," he continued. "What makes you think..."
"Just do it,"
she snapped. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see her elbow Quintaro.
"Just do what I'm paying you to do and stop bitching," he said. "Yes, sir, right away, sir," said Scorpio. "Subservience doesn't become you," noted Merlin. "If you've got a quicker way to make the 20 grand we need to repair the ship, I'll punch him out. Otherwise, we play the game."
"Here,"
said Sapphire, in another half mile. Scorpio ordered the boat onto a sandy beach, paused until it had morphed back into a vehicle, and began driving it along a narrow animal trail, all the while wondering how Sapphire could know that this particular trail was the one she wanted, even if she'd had some treasure map and committed it to memory. The tides rose, they fell, and what was a trail today might have been an ocean bottom or an empty plain in antiquity when the map would have been created, if indeed there was a map and a godstone at all. They proceeded along the trail for 3 hours. Then, as the sun was starting to set, spreading a soft golden hue through the thick cloud layer, Scorpio brought the vehicle to a sudden stop.
"What is it?" demanded Quintaro.
But Scorpio and Merlin, who had a better view of the trail, were out of the car and racing ahead on foot. They reached the object of their attention in seconds and knelt next to a blood-covered, thick-bearded man dressed in tattered rags. Scorpio was about to pull him off the trail when he realized that there probably wouldn't be another vehicle along for years, maybe decades, so he decided against moving the wounded man. Instead, he made a very crude pillow out of a stand of weeds and used it to prop up the man's head, then opened what was left of the man's shirt and began examining his body for wounds.
"Something with claws has ripped him up pretty badly," he reported as Quintaro ran up to them. "I have never seen paws on a hare before, so it's almost certainly a predator, and that means the claws were probably carrying half a dozen diseases picked up from victims."
"He is very groggy, and perhaps a bit delusional," said Merlin silently. "But something is very strange here. I mean, other than his being here at all."
"What is?"
"He was ripped to shreds by a predator, but pull what's left of his shirt off his left shoulder."
Scorpio did so.
"Son of a bitch," he muttered,
as the shoulder displayed a fresh laser burn, clearly just a few hours old.
"Let me suggest that whatever ripped him up did so as he was escaping from whoever burned his shoulder," said Scorpio.
"Makes sense," said Quintaro. He frowned. "But who else would be in this godforsaken wilderness?"
"Who, indeed?" said Sapphire, joining them.
Scorpio couldn't get over the notion that she sounded amused, though her expression gave nothing away. Scorpio examined the man's body to see where to staunch the bleeding, and realized that there were just too many flesh wounds to close them all, or even half of them, before he bled to death.
"Merlin, go to my bag and find the strongest stimulant I've got in the med kit.
Why waste it? He's as good as dead. Let's see if we can wake him up long enough for him to tell us who the hell did this to him. I don't know about you, but I'd like to know what areas to avoid."
Merlin took off without sending another thought, and was back a moment later with the entire kit.
Why the whole thing? I don't know one stimulant from another.
Scorpio opened the kit, pulled out the one he wanted, pulled out a lozenge, and pressed it against the inside of the man's upper lip, holding it in place for the count of 10. By 8, the man had opened his pain-filled eyes.
What? Where? He mumbled. You're among friends, said Scorpio. Do you remember what happened to you? Some kind of monster ran right through camp. Killed about half of us. I got in the way when one of my team took a shot at it. I don't remember anything after that. What are you, your group, doing out here in the middle of nowhere? Asked Scorpio. You're not going to believe it, thought Merlin. Looking for...
The man's voice trailed off. Scorpio thought he had perhaps 20 seconds of life left, but then he looked past Scorpio's shoulder and tensed.
I'm sorry, Miss Sapphire, ma'am, he said. I did my best. I hope you find it.
All the tension went out of his body then. His eyes rolled back into his head, and Scorpio knew that he was dead. He laid the man's body back, stood up, and turned to Sapphire.
What the hell was that all about? He demanded.
I don't know, she replied.
He knew you, even knew your name and what you're searching for.
He didn't mention the Godstone, replied Sapphire. He might have seen me around Amber City, might have heard my name.
Bullshit, snapped Scorpio. You're not thinking of quitting, demanded Quintero. I've got to discuss it with my partner, said Scorpio. We've been lied to, and I don't know how or why. We'll go stand by that tree while you talk, said Quintero, taking Sapphire's arm and starting off through the mud. Don't bother, said Scorpio. You can't hear us wherever you are. Well, thought Scorpio. He wasn't delusional, replied Merlin. He knew her name, knew she's after the Godstone. What makes no sense is that, as I say, he wasn't delusional or delirious. This whole thing doesn't make any sense, thought Scorpio. That's what's disturbing. So do we quit or not? It's up to you.
Scorpio considered his options.
I say we stay. The money means that much to you? I mean, we can make it elsewhere. We always manage. Right now, the money's got nothing to do with it. This is a hell of a mystery, and I don't plan to spend the rest of my life wondering about it.
Merlin shrugged, a gesture that sent ripples down both of his sides.
Okay.
Scorpio turned to Sapphire.
We'll continue. For now.
If he expected to see anything, gratitude, arrogance, any change of expression at all, he was disappointed.
Then let's get back to the vehicle and get started before it gets bogged down in the mud, said Quintero. If there's another group hunting for the stone, we don't want to lose any time. Acting or telling the truth? Asked Scorpio. I keep telling you, he's the dupe, she's the brain. He hasn't got enough sense to act, except when it comes to lying about paying us. All right, said Scorpio. Let's climb back in. What about him? Asked Quintero, indicating the dead man. There won't be a bone left by morning, answered Scorpio. And if we bury him in this muck, they'll just dig him up 5 minutes after we're gone.
They reached the vehicle and were soon heading deeper into the jungle, with Sapphire directing Scorpio to make minor course corrections every few miles. When it was too dark to go any further, Scorpio tried to decide, as he did every night, whether they'd be safer on land or on the nearby river.
You ask every night, and my answer's always the same. There's stuff that can cause you problems either way, replied Merlin when Scorpio queried him.
Scorpio considered his options and decided to remain on the land. If something was going to sneak up and attack, it didn't make much difference whether it hid in the thick jungle or beneath the surface of the water, but he would feel better defending himself on dry, well, soggy, land. He tried to find a place where at least they couldn't be attacked from above, but there was no escaping the huge, towering trees that gave shelter to arboreal predators. Finally, he found an area that looked minimally flatter and more protected from the rain, and announced that they were spending the night there.
Can't you find something with less bugs, at least?
Complained Quintero.
Shut up, said Sapphire coldly and emotionlessly, and Quintero immediately fell silent. The four of them sat in total silence for half an hour. Scorpio was about to drift off to sleep when something nudged his arm. He thought it was Merlin, but when he opened his eyes, he found that it was Sapphire.
Yeah, he said.
She placed a finger to her lips. Softly. There's movement out there. Intelligent movement. He stared at her.
You sure it's not the group our dead friend belonged to? The one with a blue woman named Sapphire?
She stared at him for a long moment, no emotion crossing her face. Finally, she said,
There are seven distinct sentient races on Venus.
That we know about, he answered, staring at her meaningfully.
The movement out there is directed by intellect, she continued. They are not human, and they have never heard of the Godstone.
Then I say live and let live, said Scorpio.
Do not be a fool, she said. I would not awaken and warn you if there was no danger. They are creatures that are endemic to the jungle, and they prey on strangers.
They must be starving, said Scorpio, unimpressed. Nobody wanders through here without a purpose. That can't afford them much sustenance.
They plan to eat you, you and Quintero, but only after they rob us first.
But not you.
She stared at him for a long moment.
I was mistaken, she said.
About what?
You are a fool.
She got up and walked back to where she had been sitting.
Merlin, were you listening? Well, observing, anyway. Are these critters really out there, and are they intelligent? They're out there, they're sentient. I would question intelligent. They plan to attack? That's a given. How did she know? We'll worry about that later. Tell Quintero not to fire his weapon when the fighting starts. He might hit me in the dark.
You need some help?
If I do, I'll let you know.
Scorpio looked around and saw that Merlin had already departed in what he assumed was the direction of what he now thought of as the enemy. He decided that they needed a term for them, not for their race, of which he was still ignorant, but for their occupation, because given his surroundings, highwaymen seemed ridiculous. There wasn't a highway within 1,000 miles, and except for himself and Quintero, there weren't any men within miles. He considered giving Sapphire a reassuring smile, decided she didn't need one, and sat perfectly still, trying to pick up any unusual sounds through the driving rain. Nothing happened for almost 10 minutes. Then the calm was shattered by a hideous scream. A minute later came another. The area 2 miles to the east was briefly illuminated by weapons fire, then another scream came to his ears.
3 dead, 2 running away as fast as they can. Good, thought Scorpio. What race were they? Tabola. They just crossed over the barrier to sentience about 2 millennia ago. They're the most primitive of our sentient races. Okay, bring back their weapons if they're any better than ours. They aren't, and I'll see you in a few minutes. I'll be back in the morning. I haven't eaten in 2 days. Did you have to say that? Thought Scorpio disgustedly. Well, you did ask.
Scorpio shut his eyes for a moment, trying to rid himself of the mental image of Merlin eating his enemies. The fact that they were raw didn't help, and then reopened them and found himself staring at Sapphire, who stared back, unblinking.
It's over, he said. But you know that, don't you?
She offered no answer, and her expression never changed.
Who the hell are you?
He continued after a moment. Still no answer. Or perhaps I should ask, what are you?
Leave her alone, said Quintero. To quote your blue friend, shut up, said Scorpio.
Quintero's face darkened, and he seemed about to get to his feet when Sapphire laid a hand lightly on his arm.
He is right, she said coldly. Shut up.
The anger didn't vanish, but he didn't say another word. They sat silently facing each other. Scorpio paid no attention to Quintero but stared directly at Sapphire. His only observation by the time he fell asleep 20 minutes later was that she never blinked.
Merlin had rejoined them by the time Scorpio awoke. Quintaro was sprawled in a water-resistant one-man tent, snoring, and Sapphire was sitting motionless, her back against a tree trunk, protected from the rain by the overhanging branches, exactly as she'd been when he'd fallen asleep. His first thought was that she had somehow died during the night, but when he got to his feet, she did the same.
"Wake your friend and we'll be on our way," said Scorpio.
She stepped on the splayed fingers of Quintaro's left hand.
"Damn!" he yelled, getting to his knees and shaking the hand vigorously.
Then he saw who had been responsible for it, and all anger vanished.
5 minutes to take care of your morning ablutions, announced Scorpio. We'll eat in the vehicle.
Why do I detect added tension? Asked Merlin. I thought I was the one taking all the risks last night. You ever see her eat, or sneak off to relieve herself? No, but I already told you she wasn't human. I could fill a book with things she isn't, replied Scorpio. What the hell is she? I have no idea. Was she in any danger last night? Can she even feel pain? There is an easy way to find out. Oh? You'll see.
Quintaro returned a couple of minutes later. Scorpio walked off for a few minutes and returned, and the four of them began approaching the vehicle, which was about 10 yards away. As they did so, Merlin accidentally bumped against Sapphire, and her upper arm made contact with the branch of a thorn-covered bush.
Merlin apologizes, said Scorpio quickly.
Not a problem, she replied.
You're bleeding, he noted,
indicating a pair of dark spots that suddenly appeared at the point of contact. She looked at her arm, said, oh, and continued walking to the vehicle.
Hypothesis, thought Merlin. If you cut her, she bleeds. She just doesn't feel it or care about it.
They reached the vehicle, climbed into it, and began moving. Scorpio tried to think of the direction as inland, but he was so thoroughly lost and so completely surrounded by jungle, except for a handful of narrow, winding trails, that the whole planet seemed inland from where he was.
Any idea how much farther we have to go?
He asked Quintaro, on the assumption that there was no sense asking Sapphire.
Beats me, he said.
He jerked a thumb towards Sapphire.
She's my map.
Has she deigned to tell you what we do when we get there?
Pick it up and go home, answered Quintaro. I mean, is it above the ground? Is it in plain sight? Is it guarded? And if so, by who or by what?
I don't know, said Quintaro. I just know it'll put us on Easy Street for life. Is he holding back anything? Or maybe out and out lying? Asked Scorpio. Nope. View him as 100% dupe. Why did she choose him, I wonder? Half the reason is in your pocket.
After an uneventful 3 hours, the rain finally became no more than a light drizzle. Scorpio stopped just to rest his eyes for a few minutes. Quintaro got out to stretch his legs, as did Merlin, who found the vehicle especially unsuited to a member of his race.
How's your arm?
Scorpio asked Sapphire, who had remained seated.
It's fine, she replied. But you knew that.
We could talk about all the things I don't know instead, offered Scorpio. Quantum mechanics, ancient Mercurian pottery, god stones.
You know what you need to know, said Sapphire.
I hope you don't think I want the damn thing for myself, said Scorpio. If I did, I wouldn't be driving you to it.
That is not a satisfactory answer, Mr. Scorpio.
Oh?
Mr. Quintaro and I are in your power. He is a fool, as well you know.
And you are?
A weak, helpless woman, she answered.
That may be a record, said Scorpio, smiling at her. 3 lies in a 4-word sentence.
She did not return his smile, but she took no offense, and indeed didn't react at all.
So what does a godstone do? Continued Scorpio.
She stared at him and did not answer.
You said it was worth more than diamonds. Forgive my ignorance, but what is worth more than diamonds?
Silence.
How long have you been looking for it?
No answer.
A year?
3 years?
A pause.
10,000 years?
No reaction and no answer.
Sooner or later, we really have to have a little talk, said Scorpio. A two-sided talk. I'm sure you think my partner and I are expendable, just as I know you think Quintaro is. Leaving aside whether Merlin and I can take care of ourselves, if there is a Godstone, whatever the hell that means, is Venus expendable?
Venus is my home, she said in cold, flat, emotionless tones. So you can answer when you want to. She stared at him and offered no reply.
What makes you want to? He asked. For example, how about an identical blue woman named Sapphire who is leading an expedition that's looking for something called, you'll never believe this, a Godstone? You think that might be an interesting topic of conversation?
Try not to be as big a fool as Quintaro.
You sure know how to hurt a guy, said Scorpio.
Yes, I do, replied Sapphire. You would do well to remember that. It's never far from my mind, he assured her.
One last question.
Good.
For this conversation, he qualified.
He stared at her. Did you pick us or did Quintaro? He held up a hand.
Before you say it was him, I know who approached us and made the offer. But was it his idea or yours?
He has no ideas, said Sapphire.
All right, said Scorpio. Then let me ask you, why us?
He told you why. You are said to be the most lethal man on the planet, and even I do not know who or what will be guarding the Godstone.
He stared at her for a long moment. Okay, he said at last. We'll talk again later.
She neither confirmed nor contradicted him, but merely stared at him.
Or through him, he decided.
He climbed out of the vehicle, walked around for a few moments to get a little life back into his legs, then joined Merlin, who was staring at some large golden fish in a stream.
You're hungry after everything, or everyone that you ate last night? He asked with a smile. No, I just like their colors and the patterns they make when the light hits them through the water. Our blue-skinned passenger thinks we're going to run into some trouble when we finally reach the Godstone. I know. I see the conversation in your mind. What do you think? Asked Scorpio. We're just pawns in whatever game she's playing. We could steal the vehicle right now, strand them here, and go back to McEnany's tavern. Quintaro probably won't last a day, but somehow I think it would only prove a minor inconvenience to her. I think we don't want to be looking over our shoulders for the rest of our lives. Okay, said Scorpio aloud. It was just a suggestion. Let's get back to the vehicle.
He called to Quintaro, and a few moments later the vehicle was making its way along the muddy trail. They came to the first fork they'd encountered in almost 2 days, and Sapphire directed Scorpio to keep to the left. He did so, and soon the road began winding downhill. By nightfall, they were running alongside a major river, perhaps 2 miles across. The rain returned with a vengeance, and they spent the night inside the vehicle, doing their best to ignore the thunder and the discomfort. At dawn they began again, but within a mile the trail had totally washed away, and Sapphire directed Scorpio to take the amphibious vehicle into the river, which paralleled the trail for quite a few miles, and simply keep to the water until the trail was passable again.
I hate all this water, complained Quintaro. Be glad you have it, replied Scorpio, plunging the vehicle into the river as it morphed into a boat. Be glad of this? Comes from the clouds, said Scorpio. No clouds, no rain, but also no clouds, and this is a desert world too hot for anything to live on it. They live on Mercury, don't they? Said Quintaro irritably. Not on the sunward side they don't, replied Scorpio. They stick to the Terminator zone and the dark side. You've been there, I presume, said Quintaro dubiously. A couple of times, Scorpio confirmed. Not my favorite place.
Scorpion, said Sapphire suddenly. Hard left. Scorpio instantly did as she ordered, and saw a huge creature about the size of a humpback whale, far more reptilian than fish or mammal, suddenly surface where they had been, pluck 3 low-flying avians out of the sky in its gaping jaws, then vanish beneath the water again.
I've seen stuff like that in the ocean, remarked Quintaro. But inland? In a river?
This isn't like Earth, explained Scorpio. It's all fresh water, and every creature that lives in the one can swim in the other.
God, I hate this world, snapped Quintaro.
Then what are you doing here?
Quintaro made a face.
Looking for action. I'd been hearing about Baxitla, that's a Venusian card game, for years. So I thought I might as well give it a try. A smug smile. Did okay, too. You cost me less than one night's winnings, and I met her.
He jerked a thumb in Sapphire's direction.
And once we get our hands on the Godstone, I plan to open my own casino in Marsport. Just what Marsport needs, thought Scorpio. An 84th casino, or is it the 85th? It's all academic, answered Merlin. However this ends up, you don't think he's going to make any money, do you?
Scorpio gave the creature 5 minutes to get sufficiently downstream, then guided the VZ-4 back to the center of the river. They proceeded for another 7 miles. Then he decided that the trail was safe enough to handle the vehicle, so he ordered the wheels to emerge, withdrew the rudder into the interior, and was soon traversing the jungle road once more.
How's this thing fixed for fuel? Asked Quintaro. I haven't noticed you refreshing the pile or whatever the hell it runs on since we started.
It's got a series of atomic batteries, answered Scorpio. We started with 12 and we've drained 2 of them and are on our 3rd. He paused, then added with a smile.
It's your vehicle. I figured you'd have asked the salesman.
Took it right out of the showroom, answered Quintaro smoothly. Then,
will we have enough to get back?
Depends on where we're going, said Scorpio.
Ask your lady friend.
Which ended the conversation. The rain increased as night fell. The trees weren't clustered enough or carrying enough foliage to provide sufficient shelter, and they slept in the vehicle once more. Merlin was gone when Scorpio awoke, but that wasn't unusual. The Venusian was out hunting for a meal, and he'd be back when he'd killed and eaten it.
Does it ever cool off?
Muttered Quintaro, as he climbed out of the vehicle and went off toward a cluster of trees.
Sure, said Scorpio. As soon as the rain stops.
Quintaro glared at him, then disappeared behind the trees.
We're alone again, noted Scorpio. Care to continue our conversation?
No answer.
May I take your silence as an affirmative?
Does that pass for wit on Earth? She asked coldly.
Haven't you been there?
She stared at him without speaking.
I hope to hell this damned stone exists, and it's everything you think it is. It exists, she said with absolute certainty.
With a name like Godstone, it must be part of some religion, he continued.
She remained silent.
You might tell me a little something about it, including where you think it is. I'd hate to have the other dragon lady get there first.
She gave him a contemptuous glare, then got out of the vehicle, walked to the far side of the clearing, and raised her unblinking face to the sky, oblivious of the rain cascading down.
Come on back, he said, half shouting to be heard over the rain. I won't ask any more questions. This morning, he added mentally.
She stood motionless for a full minute. He sat where he was, watching her, thinking that under other circumstances he could admire a figure like that all day, especially the way the water made her outfit cling to it. But all he could do was wonder what was going on inside that head. Finally, she returned to the vehicle just as Quintaro reappeared. Then it was simply a matter of waiting for Merlin. When he hadn't shown up for another half hour, Scorpio got out of the vehicle. He couldn't search for tracks. They were washing away almost as fast as they were made, and besides, Merlin's had probably been made hours ago. But he felt he had to do something, even if just get wet. He heard chattering in the branches above him, looked up, and saw a family of monkey-like bipeds huddled against the rain. They didn't have tails like the monkeys of Earth did, but growing out of each wrist was not only a hand, but a long, thin tentacle that functioned like a tail, wrapping around limbs to secure the owner's position. After another few minutes, a thought reached him.
Stop standing in the rain, you idiot, and get the med kit ready. I'll be there in another minute.
Scorpio rushed around to the back of the vehicle, opened it up, and got the kit.
As he did so, Merlin broke through the foliage and came into view, limping painfully across the small clearing.
"What the hell happened to you?" said Scorpio. "You need help getting into the vehicle?"
"No, I can make it," thought Merlin, and proved it by jumping up into it, emitting a pained grunt. "I can't reach my wounds. Rub some antiseptic and painkiller on them."
Scorpio applied the proper medications.
"I take it breakfast fought back," he said as he rubbed them in.
"No, there's another safari out here." "A safari? I don't know what else you'd call it." "They can't be on foot." "No, they're in a pair of vehicles. There are only four of them left. Well, three now. One of the men took a shot at me, probably thought I was dinner. He did me some damage, as you can see. When he knew I was hit, he left the vehicle and came after me." "You killed him, of course," thought Scorpio. "Of course. I wonder what the devil they're hunting for this far from what passes for civilization." "I thought you'd never ask," replied Merlin. "They're after the Godstone, and they've got a blue-skinned lady guiding them." "Oh, shit."
Scorpio paused for a moment.
"Is this the same group as the guy we found a couple of days ago?" "Probably. Probably. He died before I could find out."
"How far are they from us?"
"Maybe 4 miles west, 5 at the outside." "Okay, try to get some rest."
Scorpio closed and latched the back, then walked around and climbed onto his seat.
"Is he all right?" asked Quintaro, without much interest. "He's a hard one to kill," answered Scorpio.
He turned to face Sapphire.
"Mind if I ask you a question or two?"
"Yes," she answered.
"Live with it," he said. "My first question, have you got a sister?"
She didn't answer, but he thought he could see the muscles in her face suddenly become tense.
"Okay," he said, "I've got another one, and this time I'm going to insist on an answer." "Leave her alone," snapped Quintaro. "Be quiet," said Scorpio. "This doesn't concern you."
He turned back to Sapphire.
"Are we in a race?"
"No,"
she said. "You're sure?"
She merely stared at him.
"You might as well proceed," thought Merlin. "You can't turn back, not now that you've as much as told her we're within walking distance of her double safari. You really think she can stop us or do us harm if we do turn back? I'm incapacitated, and you're in no more danger going forward than going back to the tavern against her wishes." "Shit. I hate it when you make sense."
Scorpio put the vehicle in gear and began proceeding once again along the muddy trail. They travelled for 2 more hours, and suddenly Scorpio could see another river, or an equally broad branch of the river he was paralleling, sweeping toward them from his right. He brought the vehicle to a halt and turned once again to Sapphire.
"All right," he said. "Either I'm going to have to cross the river at some point in the next couple of miles, or I'm going to turn to the right. But even then, we're going to be confronted by another river. So which way do you want me to go?"
"Straight," she said.
"You're sure?"
She merely stared at him. He shrugged and began moving forward again. The forest began thinning out, and suddenly he came to a valley that was almost devoid of trees, and again he stopped.
"What now?" demanded Quintaro.
"That ground looks awfully soft," replied Scorpio. "I know this is a VZ-4, but I don't know if even it has enough muscle to get us out of there if we bog down."
"It's not there," said Sapphire.
"What's not there?"
asked Scorpio, surprised that she'd offered an unsolicited comment.
"What I want," she replied. "Go around it."
"Okay,
to the right," she added.
"You sure?"
he said.
"If Merlin's correct, that's the direction your kid sister's coming from."
"Shut up,"
she said, and turned to look out over the landscape. Scorpio followed her instructions, found a long unused path, he hesitated to call it even a trail, and began carefully moving along it.
"How are you doing back there?" he asked.
"I'll live," answered Merlin. "Or if I don't, it won't be the wounds that kill me.
We're getting close." "We're getting close to the guys that tried to kill you. I don't know that we're getting close to the Godstone. I still can't read her mind, but she's getting so excited, the whole vehicle reeks of it."
"It does?"
"Well, It does if you're a Venusian.
Scorpio kept the path. In about a mile it widened, and suddenly the rain completely stopped. One minute it was pouring as it had been doing for months, and one minute it was like a dry summer day on Earth.
What happened to the rain? Asked Quintaro. It's like there's an invisible wall and nothing's fallen on this side of it.
I don't know, replied Scorpio. He glanced at Sapphire.
One of us doesn't seem surprised.
She offered no reply, as he had known she wouldn't, and he continued moving forward. The path, which was once again a trail, remained thoroughly muddy.
That's damned strange, he thought. What is?
The rain stopped, yet the trail's as muddy as if it has been pouring for weeks, right up to a minute ago.
I have no answer. I'll settle for a guess. I don't feel good about this.
Scorpio waited for a comment from anyone, even Quintaro. When none was forthcoming, he sent the vehicle forward. He proceeded for 300 yards, then 4, then 5. And then he heard it, like the loudest kind of thunder, but it was coming from ahead and below, not above.
What the hell is that? Demanded Quintaro nervously. A waterfall, said Scorpio. Like it or not, this is the end of the line.
Not quite, said Sapphire. Keep going.
Those falls can't be a mile away, protested Scorpio.
Just where the hell do you want me to go? I'll tell you when to stop, she said.
What do you think? You might as well, answered Merlin. One way or another, we're going to her destination. Why walk?
Scorpio began moving the vehicle very slowly. He'd gone another quarter mile when two slightly older, less elegant, mud-covered vehicles came into sight off to his right. Quintaro pulled a pulse gun out of his pocket and started to take aim when Sapphire brought the edge of her hand down on his wrist, so hard that Scorpio could hear the bone crack even over Quintaro's scream of pain.
"You goddamn bitch!" he bellowed. "I'm trying to protect our fucking interest!"
"You don't even know what our interest is," she replied, her voice thick with contempt.
"I know what mine is," he snarled, "and no one's going to double-cross me."
He turned and took a swing at her with his uninjured hand. Scorpio didn't see what happened next, but an instant later Quintaro collapsed, unconscious, on the floor of the vehicle. Suddenly, Sapphire reached forward and handed Scorpio a wad of bills. "Here is what he owed you," she said. "You know, of course, that he had no intention of ever paying it."
"I know," said Scorpio, pocketing the cash.
"He is of no further use to us," she continued. "Stop the vehicle." Scorpio came to a stop, and she opened the door and shoved Quintaro's body out into the mud.
"Is he dead or alive?" asked Scorpio.
"One or the other," said Sapphire. "Now proceed."
"To where?"
"Do you see that tall skeleton of a dead tree ahead of us? Hard to miss. First dead tree I've seen since we started. That is our destination."
"We've come all this way for a barren tree," said Scorpio.
"Do not appear a bigger fool than I think you to be," replied Sapphire.
"Are we trying to beat the other party to it?"
"It makes no difference, for they are the same." Scorpio frowned.
"Does that make any sense to you?"
"None." Scorpio drove to within 50 feet of the tree and came to a stop. He and Sapphire got out immediately, and he walked around the back, unlatched it, and helped Merlin to the ground. The Venusian was still unsteady on his feet, but he walked by his partner's side, trying his best to ignore the pain. The two other vehicles had stopped also, and Scorpio observed them closely, waiting to see just how much this other blue-skinned woman resembled Sapphire. But when she emerged from the second vehicle, he stared, blinked, rubbed his eyes, and stared again.
"They could be twins," he thought. "Or somehow even closer," answered Merlin.
"There will be protections, of course," said Sapphire. The woman Scorpio now thought of as the other Sapphire uttered a terse command, and two men who had been driving the vehicles walked cautiously toward the tree, weapons in hand. When they got within 5 feet of it, there was a sound of static, and both men collapsed, one screaming,
one unconscious or dead. Now it is our turn, said Sapphire.
I'm not going to walk right up to it, answered Scorpio. I just saw what happens to men who do that.
Nevertheless, it might help if you tell me what I'm looking for. You already know, she said.
Is the tree the Godstone?
Of course not.
Then what is it, where is it, and what does it look like?
The stone is irregularly shaped, perhaps a foot in width. Do you see that hole at the base of the tree?
Yeah, it looks like some animal has burrowed in.
Eons ago, one probably did, but now that is where the Godstone is. You will approach on hands and knees, hopefully below the tree's ability to see or detect you, and bring it back.
That's suicidal, said Scorpio.
Perhaps not.
I'll prove it to you, he said.
He reached into the vehicle, pulled out Quintaro's pulse gun from where it had fallen, bent over, and hurled its sidearm at the hole. It was never more than 18 inches above the ground, and it burst into flame when it was within 3 feet of the tree. Scorpio straightened up.
Like I said, suicide.
It must be retrieved, she said, and for the first time he detected a trace, more than a trace, of emotion in her voice.
Oh, Merlin and I can get it for you, said Scorpio. I'm just trying to come up with a price.
You've been paid.
I've been paid for taking you here.
Risking our lives to retrieve a protected treasure wasn't part of the bargain. You will get it now, she demanded, her face suddenly a mask of fury.
I'm thinking, he said. I'd ask for this vehicle, which would certainly bring a healthy price once we clean it up, but we both know it's stolen property, and something tells me that you're not going to share the Godstone with me no matter what you promise. You're really not in a very good bargaining position, Blue Lady.
I can kill you right now, she said. You know that, don't you?
I'm a little harder to kill than you think, said Scorpio. But even if you can, you'd better be sure you know how to get the stone without me.
She glared hatefully at him, but said nothing.
Okay, he said after a moment's consideration. There's got to be a black market dealer who's not too fussy and has a market for a VZ4. I'll take the vehicle once we're done here. Do we have an agreement? She nodded. All right.
He pulled out his laser pistol and aimed a beam right at the tree trunk, about 10 feet above the ground. What are you doing? Demanded Sapphire.
It'll take a lot more than this to melt a stone, said Scorpio.
As the trunk began smoldering, then burst into flame, he trained his beam on a low-hanging branch.
Damn good thing it's not raining here. No way I could set it on fire if it were.
He turned to Sapphire.
Somebody on your side has a hell of a lot of powers, but very little brain.
In seconds, the branch was aflame, and Scorpio trained his weapon on another branch. As he did so, he leaned down, picked up a heavy stick, and hurled it at the opening. Nothing happened, except that the stick bounced off the trunk.
Okay, Merlin, he said. In and out quick. I don't know when this damn tree might collapse.
The Venusian limped ahead, reached the tree, inserted his head and neck into the opening, and emerged a moment later with an irregularly shaped crystal in his mouth.
The stone, breathed Sapphire.
And suddenly, Scorpio became aware of the other blue woman racing forward, an ecstatic expression on her face, the mirror image of Sapphire's. At first he thought she was intending to stop at Sapphire's side. Then he realized that she was heading straight at Sapphire, probably to give her a hug of shared triumph. But finally he saw that she wasn't slowing down, and that Sapphire had turned to face her and was making no effort to avoid the collision. Except that there wasn't a collision at all. He couldn't tell which of them absorbed the other, or if both had somehow formed halves of a totally new body, but suddenly there was just one female. He hesitated to think of her as a woman, standing before him. She took the stone from Merlin and held it up. Scorpio noticed that there was an irregularly shaped hole in it, maybe 2 inches across, very near the center. Sapphire began uttering a chant, not quite singing it, but more than merely reciting it.
You recognize the language? Asked Scorpio.
I know every tongue in current use on Venus, but I've never heard this one before.
Suddenly, the stone became brighter, then brighter still, and finally blindingly bright. Scorpio had to close his eyes, and though he was standing right next to it, he couldn't feel any additional heat. Then a powerful masculine voice broke the silence.
"At last," it bellowed. "At last I live again."
Scorpio opened one eye, expecting to be blinded again. Instead, he saw a huge blue man, 12 feet tall, burly and heavily muscled, sporting a thick beard and clad in a glittering robe that seemed to be a softer, pliable version of the stone.
"A thousand times, a thousand years, I have waited for the day I always knew would come."
He reached out and enclosed Sapphire's extended hand in his powerful fingers. As he made physical contact with her, as their hands touched, both of them became as bright as the stone had been a moment ago, and they began growing until they soon were taller than the tallest of the surrounding trees. He spoke once more, his voice as loud as a thunderclap.
"I am complete again!"
Scorpio tried to watch them, but again his eyes could not stand the brightness, and he had to close them. He kept them closed for almost a minute. Then he suddenly sensed that the brightness had dissipated. He opened his eyes, as did Merlin, and found that they were alone, that there was no trace of either Sapphire or the being, he couldn't help thinking of it as a god, that had been imprisoned in the stone. He suddenly remembered the stone, leaned down, and picked it up.
"The hole is gone," observed Merlin.
"I know," answered Scorpio silently.
"He is complete again."
Scorpio carried the stone to his vehicle and placed it on a cushioned seat.
"Pity to leave the other two vehicles behind, but hot or not, the VZ-4 is worth more than both of them put together. Let's head back to McEnany's tavern and get those repairs made to the ship."
"And the stone?"
"I think we'll keep it as a souvenir," replied Scorpio. "After all, how many bona fide gods and goddesses do we plan to meet in the future?"
He helped Merlin into the vehicle, climbed in himself, and began heading back the way they'd come.
"Now, let's get the hell off Venus as quick as we can."
He increased the speed.
"Why so fast?" asked Merlin.
"I'm not a practitioner of any religion, and I like it that way."
"What's that got to do with anything?"
Scorpio shrugged.
"Maybe nothing," he said aloud. "But we've just turned a god loose on the world, and I don't think he plans on going back into retirement anytime soon."
Ian MacDonald. British author Ian MacDonald is an ambitious and daring writer with a wide range and an impressive amount of talent. His first story was published in 1982. And since then, he has appeared with some frequency in Interzone, Asimov's Science Fiction, and elsewhere. In 1989, he won the Locus Best First Novel Award for his novel Desolation Road. He won the Philip K. Dick Award in 1991 for King of Morning, Queen of Day. His other books include Out on Blue Six and Hearts, Hands, and Voices, Terminal Cafe, Sacrifice of Fools, Evolution's Shore, Kirinya, Ares Express, Bracil, as well as three collections of his short fiction, Empire Dreams, Speaking in Tongues, and Cyberabad Days. His novel, River of Gods, was a finalist for both the Hugo Award and the Arthur C. Clarke Award in 2005, and a novella drawn from it, The Little Goddess, was a finalist for the Hugo and the Nebula. He won a Hugo Award in 2007 for his novelette, The Djinn's Wife, won the Theodore Sturgeon Award for his story Tendaleo's Story, and in 2011 won the John W. Campbell Memorial Award for his novel The Dervish House. His most recent books are the starting volume of a YA series, Planesrunner, another new novel, Be My Enemy, and a big retrospective collection, The Best of Ian MacDonald. His latest novel is Empress of the Sun. Born in Manchester, England in 1960, MacDonald has spent most of his life in Northern Ireland and now lives and works in Belfast. In the eloquent and evocative story that follows, we trace a trail of flowers across the planet Venus toward a troubled and uncertain destiny.
Botanica Veneris. 13 Paper Cuts by Ida, Countess Rathangan. By Ian MacDonald. Read for you by Diana Rigg. Introduction by Maureen N. Gellard. My mother had firm instructions that, in case of a house fire, two things required saving: the family photograph album and the Granville hides. I grew up beneath five original floral paper cuts, utterly heedless of their history or their value. It was only in maturity that I came to appreciate, like so many on this and other worlds, my great-aunt's unique art. Collectors avidly seek original Granville hides on those rare occasions when they turn up at auction. Originals sell for tens of thousands of pounds. This would have amused Ida. 2 years ago, an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum was sold out months in advance. Dozens of anthologies of prints are still in print. The Botanica Veneris, in particular, is in 15 editions in 23 languages, some of them non-terrene. The last thing the world needs, it would seem, is another Botanical Veneris. Yet the mystery of her final and only visit to Venus still intrigues half a century since her disappearance. When the collected diaries, sketchbooks and field notes came to me after 50 years in the possession of the Dukes of Yew, I realized that I had a precious opportunity to tell the true story of my great-aunt's expedition and of a forgotten chapter in my family's history. The books were in very poor condition, mildewed and blighted in Venus's humid, hot climate. Large parts were illegible or simply missing. The narrative was frustratingly incomplete. I've resisted the urge to fill in those blank spaces. It would have been easy to dramatize, fictionalize, even sensationalize. Instead, I have let Ida Granville Hyde speak. Hers is a strong, characterful, attractive voice, of a different class, age, and sensibility from ours. But it is authentic, and it is a true voice. The paper cuts, of course, speak for themselves. Plate 1, V. Struttio ambulans, the Ducrot's peripatetic wort, known locally as daytime walker, fent, or wander flower, thek. Cut paper, ink, and card. Such a show! At lunch, Het O'Crank mentioned that a space crosser, the quest for the harvest of the stars, a Marsman, was due to splash down in the lagoon. I said I should like to see that. Apparently I slept through it when I arrived on this world. It meant foregoing the sorbet course, but one does not come to the inner worlds for sorbet. Het O'Crank put his spider car at our disposal. Within moments the Princess Latufui and I were swaying in the richly upholstered bubble beneath the six strong mechanical legs. Upward it carried us, up the vertiginous lanes and winding staircases, over the walls and balcony gardens, along the buttresses and roof walks, and up the ancient iron ladderways of Ledec Olkoi. The islands of the archipelago are small, their populations vast, and the only way for them to build is upward. Ledec Olkoi resembles Mont Saint-Michel, vastly enlarged and coarsened. Streets have been bridged and built over into a web of tunnels quite impenetrable to non-Ledeckers. The Hets simply clamber over the homes and lives of the inferior classes in their nimble spider cars. We came to the Belvedere atop the Starostri, the ancient pharaohs of Ledec Olkoi that once guided mariners past the reefs and atolls of the Tol archipelago. There we clung. My companion, the Princess Latufui, was queasy. Vertigo, she claimed, though it might have been the proximity of lunch. The whole of Ledec Olkoi beneath us in myriad levels and layers, like the folded petals of a rose. Should we need glasses? My companion asked. No need. for at the instant the perpetual layer of grey cloud parted, and a bolt of light, like a glowing lance, stabbed down from the sky. I glimpsed a dark object fall through the air, then a titanic gout of water go up like a dozen Niagaras. The sky danced with brief rainbows. My companion wrung her hands in delight. She misses the sun terribly. Then the clouds closed again. Rings of waves rippled away from the hull of the space crosser, which floated like a great whale low in the water, though this world boasts marine fauna even more prodigious than terrene whales. My companion clapped her hands and cried aloud in wonder. Indeed, a very fine sight. Already the tugs were heading out from the protecting arms of Ocean Dock to bring the ship in to berth. But this was not the finest Ledec Olkoi had to offer. The custom in the archipelago is to sleep on divan balconies for respite from the foul exudations from the inner layers of the city. I had retired for my afternoon reviver. By my watch, though by Venusian great day it was still mid-morning and would continue to be so for another 2 weeks. A movement by the leg of my divan. What's this? My heart surged. V. Strutio ambulans. The ambulatory wort blindly, blithely climbing my divan. Through my glass I observed its motion. The fat, succulent leaves hold reserves of water which fuel the coiling and uncoiling of the three ambuli, surely modified roots by hydraulic pressure. A simple mechanism, yet human minds see movement and attribute personality and motive. This was not pure hydraulics attracted to light and liquid. This was a plucky little wort on an epic journey of peril and adventure. Over 2 hours I sketched the plant as it climbed my divan, crossed to the balustrade, and continued its journey up the side of Ledec Olkoi. I suppose at any time millions of such flowers are in constant migration across the archipelago. Yet a single ambulatory wort was miracle enough for me. Reviver be damned! I went to my space trunk and unrolled my scissors from their soft chamois wallet. Snip-snap! When a cut demands to be made, my fingers literally itch for the blades. When he learned of my intent, Jen Lalket implored me not to go down to Ledec Port, but I insisted. I insisted! At least take a bodyguard or go armed. I surprised him greatly by asking the name of the best armourer his city could supply. Best shot at the Clare Court November shoot, 10 years on the trot. Ledbeck Teltai is the most famous gunsmith in the archipelago. It is illegal to import weaponry from off-planet, an impost, I suspect, resulting from the immense popularity of hunting Ishtari Jantars. The pistol they have made me is built to my hand and strength. Small, as requested, powerful, as required, and so worked with spiral and circle archipelagon intaglio that it is a piece of jewellery. Ledec Port was indeed a loathsome bruise of alleys and tunnels, lit by shifts of grey, watery light through the high skylights. Such reeks and stenches! Still, no one ever died of a bad smell. An Earthwoman alone in an inappropriate place was a novelty, but from the non-humanoid Venusians I drew little more than a look. In my latter years I have been graced with a physical presence and a destroying stare. The Thek descended from Central Asian nomads, abducted en masse in the 11th century from their bracing steppe, now believe themselves the original humanity, and so consider terrenes beneath them. And they expected no better of a subhuman Earthwoman. I did turn heads in the bar. I was the only female, humanoid, that is. From Carfax's bestiary of the inner worlds, I understand that among the semi-aquatic crid The male is a small, ineffectual, symbiotic parasite lodging in the mantle of the female. The barman, a four-armed thent, guided me to the snug where I was to meet my contact. The bar overlooked the ocean harbour. I watched dock workers scurry over the vast body of the space crosser, in and out of the hatches that had opened in the skin of the ship. I did not like to see those hatches. They ruined its perfection, the precise, intact curve of its skin. Lady Granville Hyde? What an oily man! So well lubricated that I did not hear his approach. Stafford Grimes at your service. He offered to buy me a drink, but I drew the line at that unseemliness. That did not stop him ordering one for himself and sipping it, and several successors, noisily during the course of my questions. Years of Venusian light had turned his skin to wrinkled brown leather. Drinker's eyes looked out from heavily hooded lids. Years of squinting into the ultraviolet. His neck and hands were mottled white with pockmarks where melanomas had been frozen out. Sunburn, melancholy, and alcoholism, the classic recipe for honorary consuls system-wide, not just on Venus. Thank you for agreeing to meet me. So, you met him. I'll never forget him. Pearls of Aphrodite, size of your head, Lady Ida. There's a fortune waiting for the man. Or woman, I chided, and surreptitiously activated the recording ring beneath my glove. Plate 2. V. Flor Scopulum, the ocean mist flower. The name is a misnomer. The ocean mist flower is not a flower, but a coral animalcule of the aerial reefs of the Tellus Ocean. The seeming petals are absorption surfaces drawing moisture from the frequent ocean fogs of those latitudes. Pistils and stamen bear sticky palps, which function in the same fashion as terrene spider webs, trapping prey. Venus boasts an entire ecosystem of marine insects unknown on Earth. This cut is the most three-dimensional of Lady Ida's Botanica veneris. Reproductions only hint at the sculptural quality of the original. The petals have been curled at the edges over the blunt side of a pair of scissors. Each of the 208 palps has been sprung so that they stand proud from the black paper background. Onion paper, hard-painted card. The Honorary Consul's Tale. Pearls of Aphrodite, truly, the pearls beyond price, the pearls of Staros and Astars. But the cloud reefs are perilous, Lady Ida. Snap a man's body clean in half, those bivalves. Crush his head like a valpeculan melon. Snare a hand or an ankle and drown him. Aphrodite's pearls are blood pearls. A fortune awaits anyone, my dear, who can culture them. Charming man, Arthur Hyde. That brogue of his made anything sound like the blessing of heaven itself. Charm the avios from the trees. But natural, unaffected. It was no surprise to learn he was of aristocratic stock. Quality. You can't hide it. In those days I owned a company, fishing trips across the archipelago. The legend of the Oragunta, the island that is a fish, was a potent draw. Imagine hooking one of those. Of course they never did. No, I take them out, show them the cloud reefs, the crid hives, the wingfish migration, the air jellies, get them pissed on the boat, take their photographs next to some thawed-out javelin fish they hadn't caught. Simple, easy, honest money. Why wasn't it enough for me? I'd done the trick enough times myself. Drink one for the punters too. Yet I fell for it that evening in the Windward Tavern, drinking hot spiced cashash, and the night wind whistling up the spires of the dead crid nest haven like the caged souls of drowned sailors. Drinking for days down the great twilight. His one for my two. Charming, so charming. Until I had pledged my boat on his plan. He would buy a planktoneer, an old bucket of a sea skimmer, with nary a straight plate or a true rivet in her. He would seed her with spores and send her north on the great circulatory current, like a maritime cloud reef. 5 years that current takes to circulate the globe before it returns to the Arctic waters that birthed it. 5 years is also the time it takes the clam of Aphrodite to mature. What we call pearls are no such thing. Sperm, Lady Ida. Compressed sperm. In waters, it dissolves and disperses. Each great dawn, the Tellus Ocean is white with it. In the air, it remains compact, the most prized of all jewels. Enough of fluids. By the time the reef ship reached the deep north, the clams would be mature and the cold water would kill them. It would be a simple task to strip the hulk with high-pressure hoses, harvest the pearls, and bank the fortune. 5 years makes a man fidgety for his investment. Arthur sent us weekly reports from the Sea Wardens and the Crid Arguses. Month on month, year on year, I began to suspect that the truth had wandered far from those chart coordinates. I was not alone. I formed a consortium with my fellow investors and chartered a dirigible. And there at map 60 north, 175 east, we found the ship, or what was left of it. So overgrown was it with clams of Aphrodite. Our investment had been lined and lashed by 4 crid cantoons. As we arrived, they were in the process of stripping it with halberds and grappling hooks. Already the decks and superstructure were green with clam meat and purple with crid blood. Arthur stood in the stern, frantically waving a Cross of St. Patrick flag, gesturing for us to get out, get away. Crid pirates were plundering our investment. Worse, Arthur was their prisoner. We were an unarmed aerial gadabout, so we turned tail and headed for the nearest Sea Warden castle to call for aid. Charmer. Ha! Bloody buggering Charmer. I know he's your flesh and blood, but I should have thought. If he'd been captured by Crid pirates, they wouldn't have let him wave a bloody flag to warn us. When we arrived with a constabulary cruiser, all we found was the capsized hulk of the Planktoneer and a flock of avios gorging on clam offal. Duped! Pirates, my heart, excuse me. Those 4 cantoons were laden to the gunwales with contract workers. He never had any intention of splitting the profits with us. The last we heard of him, he'd converted the lot into Bank of Ishtar bearer bonds, better than gold, at Yeztok, and headed in country. That was 12 years ago. Your brother cost me my business, Lady Granville Hyde. It was a good business. I could have sold it, made a little pile, bought a place on Ledecti, and maybe even made it back to Earth to see out my days to a decent calendar. Instead, what's the use? Please believe me when I say that I bear your family no ill will. Only your brother. If you do succeed in finding him, and if I haven't, I very much doubt you will, remind him of that, and that he still owes me. Plate 3. V. Lilium Aphrodite. The Archipelago Sea Lily. Walk the Water in Thek. There is no comprehensible translation from Crid. A ubiquitous and fecund diurnal plant, it grows so aggressively in the Venerian Great Day that by great evening bays and harbours are clogged with blossoms and passage must be cleared by special bloom-breaker ships. Painted paper, watermarked Venerian tissue, inks and scissor-scrolled card. So dear, so admirable a companion, the Princess Latufui. She knew I'd been stinting with the truth in my excuse of shopping for paper when I went to see the honorary consul down in Ledeck Port, especially when I returned without any paper. I busied myself in the days before our sailing to Ishtaria on 2 cuts, the sea lily and the ocean mist flower, even if it is not a flower, according to my Carfax's bestiary of the inner worlds. She was not fooled by my industry, and I felt soiled and venal. All Tongan women have dignity, but the princess, possesses such innate nobility that the thought of lying to her offends nature itself. The moral order of the universe is upset. How can I tell her that my entire visit to this world is a tissue of fabrications? Weather again fair, with invariable light winds and interminable grey sky. I am of Ireland. Supposedly we thrive on permanent overcast, but even I find myself pining for a glimpse of sun. Poor Latifui. She grows wan for want of light. Her skin is waxy, her hair lustreless. We have a long time to wait for a glimpse of sun. Carfax states that the sky clears partially at the dawn and sunset of Venus's great day. I hope to be off this world by then. Our ship, the 17 Notable Navigators, is a well-built, swift Crid Jaikuna. Among the Crid, the females are the seafarers, but they equal the males of my world in the richness and fecundity of their taxonomy of ships. A Jaikuna, it seems, is a fast catamaran, steam packet, built for the archipelago trade. I have no sea legs, but the 17 Notable Navigators was the only option that would get us to Ishtaria in reasonable time. Princess Latifui tells me it is a fine and sturdy craft, though built to alien dimensions. She has banged her head most painfully several times. Captain Highly Able at forecasting, recognizing a sister's seafarer, engages the princess in lengthy conversations of an island-hopping, archipelago nature, which remind Latifui greatly of her home islands. The other humans aboard are a lofty thek, and Hugo von Trachtenberg, a German, in very high regard of himself, of that feckless type who think themselves gentlemen adventurers but are little more than grandiose fraudsters. Nevertheless, he speaks Crid, as truly as any Terrene can, and acts as translator between princess and captain. It is a Venerian truth universally recognized that two unaccompanied women travelers must be in need of a male protector. The dreary hours Herr von Trachtenberg fills with his notion of gay chit-chat, and in the evenings the interminable games of Barrington. Von Trachtenberg claims to have gambled the game professionally in the Cloud casinos. I let him win enough for the sensation to go to his head and then take him, game after game. 10 times champion of the County Kildare Mixed Bridge Championships is more than enough to beat his hide at Barrington. Still, he does not get the message. Yes, I am a wealthy widow, but I have no interest in jejune Prussians. Thus I retire to my cabin to begin my studies for the Crashite Dolium Cut. Has this world a more splendid sight than the harbour of Yeztok? It is a city most perpendicular, of pillars and towers, masts and spires. The tall funnels of the ships, bright with the heraldry of the Crid maritime families, blend with god poles and lighthouse and customs towers and cranes of the harbour, which in turn yield to the tower houses and campaniles of the Burse. The whole rising to merge with the trees of the Ishtarian littoral forest, pierced here and there by the comical roofs of the instancias of the Thent Zavas and the gilded figures of the star gods on their minarets. That forest also rises, a cloth of green, to break into the rocky palisades of the ex-palisades. And there, oh, how thrilling! Glimpsed through mountain passes, unimaginably high, a glittering glimpse of the snows of the Altiplano. Snow, cold, bliss. It is only now, after reams of purple prose, that I realize what I was trying to say of Yeztok. Simply, it is city as botany. Stems and trunks, boles and bracts, root and branch. And out there, in the city that is a forest, is the man who will guide me farther in my brother's footsteps, Mr. Daniel Oakering. Plate 4. V. Crassitae dolium, the gourd of plenty. A ubiquitous climbing plant of the Ishtari littoral, the gourd of plenty is so well adapted to urban environments that it would be considered a weed but for the gourds, which contain a nectar prized as a delicacy among the coastal fence. It is toxic to both crid and humans. The paper cut bears a note on the true scale, written in gold ink